Good morning, everyone, again, and thanks for your patience. We wanted to make sure that we captured all the audio for this fantastic discussion we're going to have today. As you probably noticed, we did change the name of HotSec this year to be a summit as opposed to a workshop, because as you all know, workshops have become basically little conferences with pre-published papers, and we really wanted to reboot HotSec to become much more focused on hot topics and security and to have lively discussion here today. So this workshop is the brainchild of Matt Blaze, who is our program chair, but unfortunately he might not be able to be here today. So I'm very pleased to say that Michael Bailey of the University of Michigan is serving as our deputy program chair, and he'll be leading us throughout the 7 different discussions we're having. First on the docket is Joseph Bonneau of Google, and he'll be speaking about the death of passwords. The format here will be presentations followed by discussions. If you'd like to speak, please raise your hand and we'll deliver a mic to you, or you're welcome to use this mic as well so that we can make sure that everybody's hearing everyone else. So enjoy.
There we go. Great. Thanks. Yeah, so I guess I have the job of being first in the new format. So wasn't quite sure what to expect, how many people would be in the room. So I put together some slides, maybe about 20. None of them are very technical. My goal wasn't really to present and throw a bunch of information at you, but to just try and highlight, I guess, what the high-level takeaways of research over the last couple years have been in passwords. And then, as my prepared material goes, I drift more into very open-ended questions. And I can say my goal in a perfect world would be to type up I guess my notes from the slides and good points I get from the audience, hopefully, into something maybe 4 to 5 pages long, which is sort of would be a cheat sheet for people who want to catch up on all the research around passwords of the past couple years. Not quite a survey, because survey means, I guess, long and you cover everything that everybody's done. Something more distilled, where it's really, these are the high points, this is what we still don't know. And I guess I can... Well, I should say, yeah, I work at Google. I'm not primarily working on password issues at Google, but have worked with multiple teams at Google doing authentication. I also did an internship at Yahoo about 2 years ago now with the authentication team there. And I was a PhD student at Cambridge up until the last summer, and my main focus of my thesis was on passwords. So I've been doing this for a couple years, but by all means, this is sort of my window, and I'm sure I missed a lot of stuff. So if you follow this link, you can get my slide deck. It's open, so you can follow along on your laptop if you want. I also turned it on for open commenting, which may have been a little dangerous, but if you don't get to say a point that you had on one slide, please add it as a comment, and then I'll be able to pick it up later when I'm trying to type this up. Okay, so I'm not sure this format matters a whole lot, but I'll just have some slides. Like I said, the first few slides, hopefully I can get through without anybody in the room feeling like they need to rush up to the microphone and say that looks really wrong. Hopefully it's stuff that there's like general consensus about. Then getting into sort of the known debates that there's one or two papers on either side of. And then to the stuff that there aren't even really papers on, because I think people aren't working on, but maybe they should be. Okay, so things that I think there's mostly a consensus on, please correct me if I'm wrong. This quote is, I don't know where it originally came from, but I was chatting with Cormac Hurley, who's written lots of stuff about passwords, and he said the conventional wisdom, frequently wrong, but never in doubt. So there's a good chance something that we think is we have consensus about will be seem silly in the future. All right, so even though the title of the session is the death of passwords, I think recently most of the papers that have come out sort of concede the point that passwords aren't going to die, at least not completely or not soon. And the goal is shifting a little bit more toward just reducing the number of passwords that people are asked to register, reducing maybe the number of websites collecting passwords. So, you know, a couple sort of broad surveys of the field are out there, and they all in one way or another come to this conclusion that, you know, if we set our goal to be completely eliminating passwords, which people have talked about for a really long time, we don't really have any short-term roadmap to achieve that that seems practical. So it looks like, again, this is where if you think what I just said is crazy, then stand up and go to the microphone. A couple of ideas that were prominent for a long time, I think, are now sort of rejected by, I'd say, the academic literature. So expiration policies, forcing people to cycle their password every 6 months. There was a pretty good paper saying that a lot of people fall into, you know, pretty simple patterns that you can predict. So if you know somebody's previous password and know that they were forced to update it, it's relatively easy to guess a few simple things that they'll try. Using personal knowledge questions, the mother's maiden name stuff as a backup authentication means. Also, you know, pretty soundly, the papers that have come out on this have said this is a bad idea on a number of fronts. Still, you know, there's still a couple scenarios where you still see this in practice for sure. I think that there's not many people writing academic papers or trying to save this idea. Using Shannon entropy as the measure of how strong a distribution of passwords are. Also the NIST formula that is supposed to be an approximation. Also pretty good consensus that's not the right metric to use. Mathematically it's wrong, and it's also very hard to actually compute in a meaningful way. So hopefully these ideas were kind of around for a long time. Hopefully they're on the way out. Kind of hope that we'll magically fix people's memory and get them to memorize a really good password, you know, has been pretty frustrating. We had a couple good empirical papers on password strength meters where you show, you know, somebody as they're typing in their password if it's good or bad, give them a little bit of feedback. The results aren't negative there. They definitely make a difference in how people choose passwords, and people generally respond well to them. But they're really more of a nudge. They can make passwords a little bit better, but they don't fundamentally change any of the threat models or how hard it is to do attacks, really. Another cool finding, if you give people a second factor, so if you say, like, you know, passwords aren't great, but maybe we can fix them if we add in, I think this paper was about adding a fingerprint scan and saying we'll do two-factor authentication with the fingerprint and a password. People actually adjust what they do in that scenario. So people will choose a weaker password if they know that there's a second factor. So human memory, you know, human capacity to choose passwords isn't even a fixed thing. People will scale it down if they think that they have some second thing protecting them. And again, that effect isn't huge. I mean, people still, they don't all choose 123456 as their password in that scenario, but you can see that it nudges people away from choosing a good password. And finally, I think the goal of doing some cognitive one-way scheme where people actually compute the one-way function of their password plus a challenge in their head and then return it, which would, you know, make them immune to phishing or at least very resistant to phishing because you'd have to do this a number of times. People are actually still proposing these things. The track record for all the ones that have been published, made into a big conference, is that they usually fall apart pretty quickly. Probably the best known one that doesn't have, you know, like isn't completely broken is this Hopper-Blum protocol, which is over 10 years old now. Hasn't really been iterated on a lot for humans to actually use. It's a little bit too hard. It's actually kind of found second life as this thing for low power devices to use, but it seems like we've kind of given up on trying to find a scheme that works there. We've also had a lot of research on the economics of how passwords get deployed in the past couple of years, with a couple of pretty good findings, I think. You can demonstrate pretty clearly that websites that do a bad job on password security, when I say bad job, websites that store passwords in clear text and email them to you, don't use SSL when you're submitting the password, let you make as many guesses as you want, and to the online server, you can try like 1,000 things, and they won't blacklist you or rate limit you. Stuff like that, kind of like the what you would say is maybe the obvious mistakes if you're going to implement passwords. That stuff's still all over the web, and it's highly correlated with websites that don't really have a strong security model. Those are the websites that you then see in the news. They get hacked. They lose a big database of passwords. Attackers can then try and use those leaked credentials at higher security sites. So this basically functions as a negative externality, like pollution, where the websites that don't really have to care about security are sort of sending out this bad password security and these huge lists of leaked passwords into the wild, and then the bigger websites sort of have to deal with cleaning that up. Another paper looked at how websites actually choose what password policy they force on users, so whether or not they force users to have something long with a bunch of characters in it or just let them use pretty much whatever they want. And the finding there was really interesting, that the only factor that really predicted how strict websites would be with which passwords they accepted is if they didn't have any competition. So things like banks, where it's very hard to switch, or government websites, school websites, those had pretty strong password policies. And then even passwords with or websites with potentially financial implications, stuff like eBay or Amazon or big webmail providers, they actually have much looser password policies. And then there's kind of the high-level consensus from that I wrote about last year with my co-authors in the survey paper, that passwords are really a Pareto equilibrium, which means that it's not possible to fix passwords without making somebody worse off. At least we don't know of any technology that just magically makes everything better in authentication without pushing some cost either onto users or onto servers or onto the net as a whole. Okay, so no points of controversy so far. All right. And on the outside of academic research, actually on the web, I'd point to a couple things over the last 5 years that we've actually seen get some real deployment, which didn't really exist before, which has been exciting. So two-factor authentication with a mobile phone, a couple of the big players have rolled this out. I think that it's still not quite like a mass market thing where the majority of the users at these sites are using it yet, but this is something where we have a user base in the tens of millions now, so there's some real experience deploying that. OAuth, I would say, has been relatively a success story in that a lot of people use it, and it did actually fix what was a bad anti-pattern before that, which was having to actually give away your password in plain text to websites that you wanted to do this delegated authentication scenario with. And I think Facebook federated authentication has also seen a lot of relying parties, which has been good. The competitors, which would be OpenID or Persona, haven't quite hit that level yet. All right, so I'll raise the degree of contentiousness one notch, I guess. Hopefully wake you guys up. Kind of open research questions where it's pretty well defined in the literature, if you can publish a paper on one side or the other, and people will know where it fits in the debate. So one question is, what's the best password policy? And by password policy, I mean what passwords you'll accept from users. Basically, do you require, what passwords do you blacklist and reject? What requirements do you have in terms of characters that they have to use or length? So caring about this problem at all, where there's two assumptions buried here. One of them is that password strength actually matters. And the second one is that users actually care about this. And then you can sort of measure password policies on which one's the least inconvenient and which one makes the biggest difference in how hard the resulting passwords are to guess. You can have a debate about how you measure what the resistance to guessing should be for a password policy. Mostly the question is, do you care about, are you improving the weakest password that people pick, or are you improving the general strength, kind of like the herd immunity effect that you're going for? So there's this NIST ranking formula that, you know, gives basically like a numeric score to different combinations of length and having a blacklist or not in different character classes. Been a couple papers that have said that this doesn't really correlate that well to how hard it is for a cracking library to actually go after those passwords. So that's not too popular. I think there's a pretty good argument about two different approaches. One of them is let people choose whatever they want, don't have a formal policy, just have a big blacklist that you update dynamically. Just prevent any one password from getting too popular. So that can be a good way to, you know, have a lower bound on how weak the weakest password is going to be. The alternate approach, I guess, that has also been argued for, a separate paper, don't have any complex requirements on characters, just have a much longer minimum length. So this Kelly et al. Paper, they actually argued that you should have a 16-character minimum length for the password and no other restrictions besides 16 characters, and that this was a much better policy than forcing people to use punctuation or to use digits or capital characters. So between those two approaches, I'd say it's not clear yet what's really better and less inconvenient. All right, a couple of special cases. I think I put special in quotes because people treat these like special cases, but that's a little funny because they all have, you know, in the millions or, you know, tens of millions of users. So one question is, you know, how do we change passwords for people who are on a device with a touchscreen or using a soft keyboard? It becomes a lot harder to enter a strong password because you don't have autocorrect. Hopefully your password, if autocorrect autocorrects to your password, then that's probably not a good situation to be in. So kind of, again, two approaches there that, you know, have been advocated for. One is that passwords should be like a long string of words so that autocorrect can actually help you out. And the other approach is probably do something graphical, like I guess for Android and for more recent Windows devices, you can unlock with a graphical password. With Android, it's the dots that you trace your finger through. And with Windows, it's a picture that you select points and do gestures on. So again, not relatively less research on this. And then there's kind of the issue of smudge attacks. So if people are always doing the same physical motion, you can pretty reliably figure out what it is by looking at what residue they're leaving from their fingers on the screen. So the implication of that is that, you know, if you really want good security, you have to actually change the orientation of where they're putting their finger on the screen all the time. And we haven't seen, at least I haven't seen a good proposal for how to do that that doesn't make the scheme hard for people to use. Another special case that, you know, represents quite a lot of people, people whose native language doesn't use the Latin alphabet or some variation of it. Looking at some, you know, leaks from people who spoke Chinese and Hebrew and some other languages, those people are forced to use an alphabet that maybe they're less comfortable with. They end up just using digits a lot of the time. So this is kind of an identified problem without any real good proposed solution for how you can make passwords better for people who aren't using Latin alphabet. And then there's like a bunch of other accessibility cases that are, you know, kind of fringe research topics, but they actually represent a lot of people. So, you know, if you want to write if you want to write a paper on good good password scheme for people who are illiterate, for people who don't understand alphabets at all, you know, who can certainly use computers to do interesting things, I think that would be a really good topic to go after. All right. Another debate, can we actually make random passwords usable in some form? I think this may be my only picture in all the slides, but I just had to include it because everybody remembers the XKCD comic strip about memorizing a sequence of random words. So Rich Shea and some researchers at Carnegie Mellon, they actually did a pretty big lab study on whether or not this works. And it actually didn't perform any better in their study than just forcing people to memorize random base 64, essentially, which was pretty surprising, actually, because intuitively it seems like the sequence of words is much better. Haven't actually been able to demonstrate that in any convincing way. Go for it, please. So they weren't letting people pick the passwords. So the passwords were like equally good. They were chosen from, you know, with an equal amount of from an equally large random space. They were just, you know, for one treatment they were represented as a sequence of words, and for the other they were represented as a more compact string of random characters. So the goodness was fixed, and then they looked at people's how often people mistyped them, whether or not they remembered them a week later. And on that, those axes, it didn't perform any better.
They weren't able to remember correct words battery stable any better than 55 completely random words.
No, it was like within the range of like not statistically significant, which was why like I thought this was a interesting paper. And by all means, like it's possible that they didn't. If you did the experiment again, or maybe did it slightly differently, you could show an effect, but it was like a null result. They couldn't show it. The only reason this is in the controversy section isn't because I think they did the research wrong. It's because most people, I think, in the field are still pretty convinced that the random word sequence is better because it just seems so much better, right? So I'd say let's write another paper about it if people still like the approach. The other research avenue on making random passwords usable is this kind of implicit memory approach, where you train people to memorize a password without actually telling them it. So they think that they're playing a game or doing some other activity, and you actually are training them to memorize some secret that you can extract out of them later. So this was, I think this paper was at USENIX last year. And the cool thing about their approach was that it takes, the training takes a long time, so this isn't the most practical scheme right now. But they were able to basically put this password into people's memory that they could replicate later, but they couldn't actually do it voluntarily. They had to get the right stimulus back. So, their goal was that if in a rubber hose situation, they weren't actually able to even admit what the secret was without having the right setup to type the thing in. All right. How to do backup authentication? I mentioned earlier that, I think there is consensus that, backup authentication by email is what almost everybody does in practice, and people are pretty happy with that. But if you're actually running a webmail provider, then maybe, you can't rely on this. Like I said, I think personal knowledge questions are, nobody's really advocating too strongly for those anymore. A couple different schemes. One of them is this social authentication or delegation, where you designate a couple of your friends to be trustees, and if you lose access to your account, the website will send some token to them, and then you have to gather them out of band by calling these people up or something like that, and then you can regain access. A couple of papers on that. There hasn't been, that I know of, a good adversarial paper where somebody tries to actually attack this and see how hard is it to get the secrets out of those people by social engineering. So that would be a good paper to do. Other approach that Facebook uses, and I think maybe a couple others, is to show photos of people that you're supposed to know and have you tag who those people are. So hopefully this is pretty easy for most people to do, to look at photos and identify their friends. There was an attack paper out of the Cambridge Research Group last year on this, saying that the scheme is maybe pretty effective against phishers or opportunistic people, but it's a pretty weak method against anyone who actually knows you, because their social circle probably overlaps and they probably know almost all the people that would be your friends in the photos. So in general, I think backup authentication is it's very hard against acquaintances like that. So coming up with a better scheme is be a good topic. All right. So I got one comment. Hopefully we'll get two in this section. More contentious statements that people have made. There's a question of doing lab studies on passwords at all. Traditionally this required taking people into a lab and having them register a password in pretty artificial scenario. I think there's been some pretty good progress on doing user studies with passwords on Mechanical Turk online. Some of the innovations there are that you have people, you don't tell them it's a password study, you just tell them they have to sign up for some website to do something else that they're getting paid for, and then you split them into different treatments. So the password is a side effect that they don't know about. But there's still some question about whether or not you should trust, how much should we take away from these studies that are done where people sign up for some website on Mechanical Turk and it's not maybe an account that they use every day? Because it's generally pretty hard to do experiments on people's real passwords. So there was a paper at SOUPS this year that was kind of ingenious. They did like the classic lab study, and then they also had access to those people's real passwords that they use for their student accounts, and they were able to compare and see something like 25% of the users just behaved normally, some others behaved sort of normally. And then there was a population of users that used either really derogatory things or just like an empty string, basically, for the experiment. So we actually do have some numbers on this. But I can say, from the perspective of program committees, things like that, the papers that get written based on a lab study, there's kind of always like a negative comment in the review that says, well, these weren't really real passwords, so I don't, why should we care at all about this this study? All right, so does password strength matter at all? A couple contrarian, although maybe not so controversial, essays have been written that basically said that this whole goal of having people pick passwords that are stronger is a waste of time. Most people don't actually have any real risk if their passwords get guessed or compromised. If their accounts get compromised, nothing really bad happens to them. And even if they do choose a strong password, it doesn't really lower the risk of compromise that much, because possibly a lot of the threat models you care about don't hinge on password strength at all. So you can make a pretty nice argument that password strength doesn't matter, and that users really don't care, and that's why passwords are so weak. The only counterpoint that I saw in Yahoo data that I analyzed is that people basically pick the same passwords no matter what they're picking them for. If it's like their webmail account or if it's just an account that they play games with, password strength really doesn't vary that much. So if it was the case that people just didn't care, and that's why most passwords are so weak, you'd expect to see a little bit more of a bump when they theoretically might care, and you don't necessarily see that. So not clear, I guess, if passwords are weak just because users really don't care about them or because it's something that they fundamentally can't do. Should we hash passwords at all? I think for a long time the conventional wisdom is like, yes, you have to hash passwords. It's really bad practice to keep databases of passwords around in clear text. You know, this year there was a pretty good convincing paper that said it's actually a bad trade-off to hash passwords. If you don't hash them, then you will have more knowledge about what people are picking, how to blacklist weak passwords, how to steer people towards better ones. And the benefit of having hash passwords is relatively low if password cracking is good, because if you lose a database of hash passwords and a cracking library can invert 80% of them in a day, then you've really only protected 20% of the users with that, with the hashing. I guess I'll go show of hands at this point to try and get a little bit more interaction here. How many people buy this argument that we should stop hashing passwords? Anybody? So the consensus is I should move this to the earlier. There's consensus that we should be hashing passwords.
It's to protect all the other logins who use the same password on.
Right.
Should be using
Scrypt, yeah. Okay. So, you know, pretty good. Well, yeah, okay. I mean, if it's Scrypt, I mean, good, you know, you can still get the weakest passwords. It may change it from 80% to 30%, but.
If you could absolutely, positively guarantee 100% that nobody could ever get to that clear text password file that you have.
Well, I mean, that's impossible, yeah. Right.
But how many places can absolutely guarantee that they will never have a security breach that will release all those passwords?
Yeah. I mean, so my name's on the counterpoint here, so I don't really agree that we shouldn't hash passwords, but I guess nobody else does either, so we'll move on. It's kind of like a long list of other things that people have looked at, which I think, you know, I could do a similar slide, like do these whole research areas matter? There's been like a bunch of papers about how to enter passwords in a way that's resistant to shoulder surfing with, you know, special hardware, fancier schemes. That's like sort of a fringe topic. People have, you know, I think I actually wrote password cracking doesn't matter or barely matters. The idea that users shouldn't write passwords down, I think that's increasingly, more people are saying that advice doesn't matter. People should write passwords down if that's easier for them. Graphical passwords, I mean, people have spent a lot of time researching those and done some really good research. They actually perform like pretty well in lab studies, but there's been like zero traction in practice for them outside of the screen unlock. So anybody want to go to bat and say like one of these things really does matter and people should keep researching it?
I would say that writing passwords down for a lot of people is a good idea.
Yeah.
And it goes at an angle or up or down or whatever. And you can put multiple passwords into that with, you know, just knowing where they start and end.
Right.
But it's a big enough, you know, it's a little bit of obfuscation that it helps.
Anybody else? Anybody think shoulder surfing is something that we should keep worrying about a lot?
Everyone has Google Glass.
What's that?
Somebody in the back? Most exciting stuff I have to throw at you, the things I think nobody's researching, in a lot of cases because the data doesn't exist. This is more stuff, you know, that I guess I've seen it at Google and Yahoo that the industry is caring about, and I think academia is missing a little bit. So, you know, I think we would all agree that there's different scenarios for authentication that all use passwords in some form, that have pretty different threat models. So, this essay that was by Eric Gross and Mayank at Google, they like categorized five different classes of accounts and said, you know, we should consider them all separately and, you know, do different requirements for each one. Not very scientific. This is kind of like a first stab at it, which I think was useful. I guess I'd, you know, ask the question, is there a way we can make this more precise? Can we actually classify, like, in some strong way why, you know, a lot of people say there's like webmail accounts and there's like kind of throwaway accounts. What are the actual like differences that we could really capture there in some kind of quantitative way would be pretty interesting. I haven't really seen any good effort to do this. The other axis that I think is really interesting is in different scenarios, how does the risk of compromise affect the user versus the site? So in some cases, maybe if, you know, the password gets guessed, it's really bad for the user and the site doesn't really care. In other cases, it, you know, might be bad for the site, you know, and if the site has to refund money or something like that because users lost their password, then maybe all the liability is on the site. So I haven't seen any effort to really classify how different scenarios vary on that axis and how it affects anything. I think password cracking and password hashing just kind of like drifted away from academics a lot. If I'm actually curious, how many people in the room are aware that there's like a competition this year to come up with a new password hash algorithm? Yeah, so I mean, there you have it. Like the goal of this was to be a crypto competition along the lines of AES or SHA-3, where the community will get together and come up with something like S-Crypt, which is a password hashing algorithm that's hard to accelerate in hardware. It's gotten like almost no attention, I think, from most academics. They may have been like the time frame was too short, or the publicity didn't happen. I mean, there's definitely people working on it online, but it's it hasn't become like a mainstream topic for crypto researchers. And similarly, like the people who are developing password cracking libraries, like I think maybe most of the room has heard of John the Ripper. Generally, yeah. I mean, how many people have heard of Hashcat? Yeah, again, it's like 5-6 people. So, I mean, that's over the last couple of years, they've like been a competitor to John the Ripper. There's a couple more now that are sort of freely available cracking libraries. But again, they actually have a competition every year too now. It was at DEF CON last week. I have a lot of quibbles with how they ran the competition, but basically, like, these two topics have like drifted completely away from what academics were thinking about. I'm not really totally sure why that happened and if it's a good or a bad thing, but I kind of wonder if there's getting more attention from academic crypto people involved would help anything. All right, I guess we've mostly covered this, but I'd say that what hasn't been done, which would be interesting, is like a large user study that's long-term, where you actually give people like holistic advice for how they manage all of their passwords online. Like have them use a password manager, have them write everything down on paper, steer people between choosing a lot of passwords that, you know, are weak or a few strong passwords, stuff like that. And then actually see, like, does that change the rate at which bad stuff happens to those people? And the goal of this would be to know, if you're talking to your grandmother, or if you're Google and Google has put a couple of billboards up and magazine ads trying to give people good security advice. And we don't, you know, necessarily know at a high level what advice we give and how it affects people. I think everybody sort of has their own system and their own advice, but we don't have any real evidence of how this affects people. I guess probably the last point to focus on. Yeah?
Comment on that previous one. There
Okay. The last thing I'd say is, if I talk about large authentication providers, so this basically means, Google, Facebook, Yahoo, Microsoft, et cetera, Twitter. The sites that have in the hundreds of millions of users and have pretty consistent attacks and now have years of experience doing this. What are the real threats that are actually matter here and are leading to compromise? I mean, all these large authentication providers have to deal with tens of thousands of compromises a day. So there's a fire hose of people getting compromised. I think certainly within the academic literature, there's no numbers about we can enumerate what the threat models are, but there's really not any good sense at all of what the relative importance is. Probably, online guessing is at the low end, probably the least important threat, but we don't have a good sense of how these things compare. And it's possible we can measure this with tracing data where you have fake accounts and you put them out in kind of a honeypot scenario. Which some of the big players have done internally and not published. It'd be nice to see a paper that just had any kind of data on this. I guess that's, since I should wrap up, that's a point to close on in general, is that I see, having gone back and forth between the two, there's a really big gap between what the large players are talking about and researching and what academics are. And a lot of this just comes down to data. There's so much data internally that just can't be shared because it's kind of security critical and sensitive. I mean, I was lucky when I did my internship at Yahoo that they were able to, or that they agreed to do the experiment I wanted to do to collect some anonymized password data. A lot of the rest of the stuff that would be interesting is kind of just off limits. I guess some questions, if anybody has wants to throw out an idea. If academics had unlimited access to data inside some large authentication provider, what experiments would be interesting to run? It'd be interesting to compare that with what has been done in-house. And obviously the providers they're busy and don't have time to sit around and do experiments all day. Versus what can academics actually do that's meaningful without having that data? I'd also turn around and say maybe there's some responsibility on the coming out of large providers to tell academics what they don't have time to do or what they don't have resources that academics could actually do. And I guess there's also a question of is there a better collaboration model than the only thing I've really seen work, which is that PhD students do internships at these places and then sometimes they do experiments and write a paper about it. But that's, from what I can tell, that's the main source of information flow between these two places. I think this is, it's kind of a big problem. My long-term fear that I worry about is that this will turn into a academic research topic that sort of dies off, not because it's not important or because people don't care about it, but because just the data isn't there, so academics are, afraid that they can't do anything. The goal is I'd like to see that study done with more success.
Yeah, one more. You were mentioning that with the two-factor authentication,
a very simple password and the two-factor be better than one typical password?
Your phone numbers are wonderful key for matching. We did